From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross.
Out of the tree of life, I just picked me a plum. You came along and everything started to hum. Still, it's a real good bet, the best is yet to come.
On today's Fresh Air, Tony Bennett. Frank Sinatra once called Bennett the best singer in the business, and who are we to argue? Bennett turned 80 years old this week. We'll listen back to an interview with him and hear some of his great recordings. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews the new film Little Miss Sunshine, starring Greg Kinnear, Toni Collette, and Steve Carell. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
Wait till our lips have met. Wait till you see that sunshine day.
First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davey, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Today we celebrate the birthday of one of our greatest singers.
This can't be love because I feel so well. No sobs, no sorrows, no sighs. This can't be love. I get no dizzy spell. My head is not in the sky. My heart does not stand still. Just hear it beat. This is too sweet to be love. This can't be love because I feel so well. But still I love to look in your eyes.
Tony Bennett turned 80 this week, and he's still performing and recording. Stephen Holden of the New York Times called Bennett the embodiment of heart in popular music. In the polluted sea of irony, bad faith, and grotesque attitudinizing that pop music has become, he is a rock of integrity.
My heart does not stand still, just hear it beat. This is too sweet to be love. This can't be love. Because I feel so well, but still I love to look in your eyes. I love to look in your eyes.
That's from Tony Bennett, the Rodgers and Hart songbook, with Ruby Braff on cornet. Terry spoke with Tony Bennett in 1998 after his autobiography, The Good Life, was published. He told Terry his father was also a singer.
In Calabria, he had a reputation for singing on the top of a mountain and the whole valley would hear it. And they enjoyed him so much.
What was his style of singing? Was it operatic or pop?
It was opera. Yes, it was opera. And my brother inherited that side of him and was at 14 years old. He was known as the Little Caruso and sang in the Metropolitan Opera, solo spots and... So that's our whole, it was a great way to start thinking about music, you know, to start right at with the greatest music of all, which is opera.
Your father died at the age of 41. How old were you?
I was 10 years old.
Did you have to go out early and support the family after his death, or help support the family?
Well, really, yes, that's the one thing I had on my mind. It was because of my mom, and I wanted to make sure she was working so hard, and I really felt for her all the time and felt that I wanted to go, you know, just get any kind of job to help her out.
So you dropped out of high school, I think, to get work?
Yes. Mm-hmm. No, well, I worked during high school, and I became a singing waiter toward the end of the... I didn't finish high school, so I became a singing waiter in Astoria, Long Island, and found that out of all the jobs, I didn't like any job I had, and it was the only job that I said, if I have to do this the rest of my life, I'll be happy doing that.
Close, huh?
Yeah.
You were drafted toward the end of World War II, and after basic training, you were sent to the front lines. Where were you sent?
I was sent as a replacement after the Battle of the Bulge, days after the Battle of the Bulge, and it was very traumatic. It really affected my whole life because I couldn't believe the deportment of the soldiers that were on the Battle of the Bulge. It was just tragic. To see how it affected their lives, to see all that killing and insanity, it was something that I'll never forget, and it changed my life.
Were there still bodies from the battle lying all around when you got there?
Yes.
You point out that more than half of the replacement soldiers became casualties within their first 3 days on the front lines. In part because they were so underprepared and the soldiers who were there were so exhausted that they couldn't help in training them much. Did you feel very underprepared for what you faced?
Well, I couldn't believe what I faced. I mean, it was a complete insanity, and it was the lower depths, the height of the lower depths, to see the mood and the psyche of the soldiers that came out of the Battle of the Bulge, and how the soldiers that had died that were their friends, and it was very morbid. It was quite tragic.
Did you have any close calls yourself?
I did, yes, yes.
While you were at the front lines during World War II, Bob Hope did a show that you got to see. And you say that had an enormous impact on you, going from the front lines to seeing this terrific show. Do you remember what songs he sang or what jokes he told?
Well, I remember Thanks for the Memory, his theme song. But more than that, you had Jane Russell on the show, and Les Brown's band, and the GIs, and I was one of them, and we couldn't believe that he was so wonderful to us, and what a memorable show. And he took us off the line. I mean, that was really, I always say that he actually saved my life, because we had 88 bombs coming at us, you know, and all of a sudden they said, "You're going back, retreating." So I thought we were retreating, and found out that it was just a release and a relief for us to just get a second wind before we went back again. And he was just, I mean, I can't tell you that how many soldiers will never forget Bob Hope for what he did for them.
I know you got to work with Bob Hope. Did you tour with him during wartime at any point?
No, it was after the war. And for about 5 years, I was just looking around for work. And then Pearl Bailey heard me down in Greenwich Village, and she was working in the club, the Greenwich Village Inn, and heard me rehearsing in the afternoon. And she told the owner, if you don't have him on the show, I'm not coming in here. And she got me started there. And then he came down from the Paramount Theater. He came down to hear Pearl and saw me on the show and got a big kick out of it and said, "Come on, you're coming up to the Paramount." And changed my name from Anthony Dominic Benedetto to Tony Bennett.
Bob Hope changed it?
Yep. He said, "Let's Americanize you. We'll call you Tony Bennett." So that was a thrill. I've had that name ever since. And when I paint, it's Benedetto, my family name. And when I perform, it's Tony Bennett.
What do you think you learned from Bob Hope in terms of show business?
Well, it's a nice Jewish expression, you know, show him you like him. You know, he always told me to, when you come out on the stage, you know, just make sure that you you show the people that you enjoy being there and you want to entertain them and show them your enthusiasm.
How do you do that?
You psych yourself out and you just do it. After a while, it becomes, you realize that it's the right way and then you really mean it.
Tony Bennett speaking with Terry Gross. Here's a 1959 recording of Tony Bennett with pianist Ralph Sharon, his longtime accompanist.
Love laughs at a king. Kings don't mean a thing on the street of dreams. Dreams broken in two can be made like new on the street of dreams. Go. You can hold is in the moonbeams. Poor, no one is poor. As long as love is sure on the street of dreams.
Well, We'll hear more of Terry's interview with Tony Bennett after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1998 interview with Tony Bennett. He turned 80 this week.
When you first signed to Columbia Records, this was in the early 1950s, Frank Sinatra was still on the label, and he and Mitch Miller occasionally had feuds about repertoire. Did you get to know Frank Sinatra during that period? Did you see yourselves as friends or as rivals?
No, I didn't know him at all at that time, but then I started getting one hit after another. I was the Madonna of my day. And what happened was I was very frightened. I was a young artist, and I got this wonderful opportunity. Perry Como had me do a summer replacement and left me with a kind of a bare stage in the summer replacement. They cut the budget away from his elaborate budget that he had and left me kind of with a bare stage on CBS. And I was very frightened about how to perform on television. Well, I just took a deep breath, and Sinatra was at the Paramount Theater with a reunion with Tommy Dorsey, and I said, I'm going to go backstage and talk to him. And I was warned, look out, he could be pretty tough. So I said, no, but I love the way he sings, and I love him personally as a fan. I'm just going to go up and talk to him. Found out that it was just the opposite of what everybody said about him. He was just wonderful to me, and sat me right down in his dressing room and gave me some wonderful advice about not worrying about being nervous, because he said the public likes that. He said if you don't care, he said, why should the audience care? He said if you're nervous, they're going to see that you care, so they're going to root for you, and the more they root for you, the more you'll give back to them. He said, it'll just be fine. And it was wonderful advice. And then he said this very same thing I was always kind of fighting for. And he said, don't ever do silly songs. Stay away from silly songs. Do very well-written songs by great composers. Well, that advice was fantastic, because it's really sustained me for 45 years now.
You recently did a tribute album to Sinatra called Perfectly Frank, and mm-hmm. I thought this would be a good time to play something from that. I thought we'd hear I Fall in Love Too Easily. Do you want to say anything about this song or about recording the album before we hear it?
Well, that was the song that made everybody, men and women, fall in love with Frank Sinatra. That was the first movie he was in, and it was a lovely song that was my favorite period of Sinatra anyway. It was the most musical, and it was the height of American popular music. I don't think it'll ever be replaced. It was he had this gorgeous gift. He was the equivalent in popular music to DiStefano in opera. He had this great musicality in his voice that was just natural and gifted. It was a golden voice, and his recording of that really proves how wonderful he sang.
Well, this is Tony Bennett singing I Fall in Love Too Easily.
I fall in love too easily. I fall in love too fast. I fall in love too terribly hard for love to ever last. My heart should be well schooled, 'cause I've been fooled in the past. And still I fall in love too easily. I fall in love too fast. I
should be well schooled, 'cause I've been fooled in the past, and still I fall in love too easily. I fall in love too fast.
Do you feel that you learned things about singing from listening to Sinatra?
Well, you know, if you listen to one, it's thievery, but if you listen to everybody, it's research. So I listen to Sinatra, I listen to Bing Crosby, I listen to Louis Armstrong. You know, it's a lot of girl singers taught me how to sing. Ella Fitzgerald and Sarah Vaughan and Carmen McRae, they're all wonderful stylists, and they do great things with intimate singing, the art of intimate singing.
You were not only a big fan of Sinatra's, he was a big fan of yours. And in a much-quoted now Life magazine article from April of 1965, he said, "For my money, Tony Bennett is the best singer in the business. He excites me when I watch him. He moves me. He's the singer who gets across what the composer has in mind, and probably a little bit more." It strikes me, though, that you lived your lives very differently, at least from my perspective, just kind of watching it. Looks like you lived your lives pretty differently. Frank Sinatra was much more in the limelight. There was the Rat Pack. He had a reputation as being much more temperamental and so on. And I'm wondering if you feel like you learned anything by watching him live his life in terms of the effect of that public life on him.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I've had a very interesting relationship with Sinatra. It's now that he's gone, I think about it and I realize, boy, that was really different, because we were never really that close. The Rat Pack was a lot closer to him. I lived on the East Coast most of the time, and he was out on the West Coast and making films and doing nightclubs in Vegas mostly. But yet I'd go see him a lot, and whenever I saw him, it was wonderful. And it was always an uppie to be around him. He was had so much fun. Nobody ever had more fun than Frank Sinatra, believe me. But then there would always be these things that always surprised me, because when I first met Orson Welles backstage at the Radio City at the Night of 100 Stars, he said, "You know," he says, "I go to every one of Sinatra's parties, and he always plays your records." You know, things like that. I would always be shocked say, "You're kidding." He said, "No, that's true." And then I realized, looking back, that every season Sinatra would always change quite a few numbers in his performance every season. He would always say something about me that was complimentary and encouraging for the public to go see me perform somewhere. He would always turn a phrase or say it a different way, but each season he would say something the whole season that would either mention the song that I recorded or say, "You got to see this guy, Bennett. He's really cooking right now." He'd say something in the audience that would promote the public to come and see me. So he really affected my career, because his huge fan clubs, they would all say, "Let's see what Sinatra's talking about." And he would really fill the seats for me. And he's always been a great friend right through the years. And then one night, just recently before he died, the last performance he gave at Radio City, I was sitting in the audience, and he said, "This is my friend." He says, "He's my best friend, not only in show business, but my best friend, period." And he had me stand up and take a bow in Radio City. And that really moved me. That was something.
It strikes me you were always a more kind of accessible performer than Sinatra. I don't mean musically, but in terms of just contact with you. I mean, Sinatra wouldn't have done a radio interview, I don't think, unless maybe with Sid Mark, who does the Sinatra show. Sinatra
right.
Probably couldn't even have played Carnegie Hall, because he had to play stadiums. And
well, no, that was later. He did play Carnegie Hall, and when he did, it was magnificent. I saw him Well, in fact, it was the best concert I ever saw in my life for a popular singer. And it was at Carnegie Hall with a tremendous orchestra of about 80 musicians and everybody in tails. And it was, it was a magnificent evening. But I know exactly what you're saying. But you see, that was the, in those days, it was the film star attitude. You know, you had to appear unattainable.
Yes, I think you put your finger on it. You had to appear unattainable, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's almost like, you know, in show business, everything's kind of a game. Each individual plays it a different way. And I've always, I liked Louis Armstrong and Ella Fitzgerald in the sense that they were truly humble and they were accessible to the fans. I learned a long time ago. I play Britain for the last 50 years now, and there are just lines of fans at the end of the performance that in a double row, and they just want my autograph. And I just stay there and sign every autograph. I mean, I just think it's, you know, if they like me, I'm going to like them.
Tony Bennett speaking with Terry Gross. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, in stores and online at bn.com. From Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created by Andrew Carnegie to promote the advancement and diffusion of knowledge and understanding. And from Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Coming up, recording two now classic albums with Bill Evans. We continue our conversation with Tony Bennett. He celebrated his 80th birthday this week. Also, David Edelstein reviews the new film Little Miss Sunshine. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Tony Bennett turned 80 this week, and he's still recording and performing. We're listening back to Terry's 1998 interview with Tony Bennett, recorded when his autobiography, The Good Life, had just been published.
I think every time you've ever done Fresh Air, I've managed to play something from one of the Tony Bennett, Bill Evans records. They're such extraordinary records.
And, Thank you.
So I thought this time around we'd play Some Other Time.
Oh, good.
So let's hear that, and then we'll talk a little bit.
Where has the time all gone to? Haven't done half the things we want to. Oh, well, we'll catch up some other time. This day was just a token. Too many words are still unspoken. Oh, we'll catch up some other time. Just when the fun is starting, comes the time for partying. But let's be glad for what we've had and what's to come. There's so much more embracing still to be done, but time is racing. Oh, we'll catch up some other time.
In your memoir, you write a little bit about doing your two records with Bill Evans, and you loved working with him, and God, these records are extraordinary. You see, the problem, though, that you saw was the depressing thing was watching how Bill Evans' drug habit interfered with his life. Did it interfere with his music, too, do you think? Did you feel it getting in the way at all of rehearsals or whatever?
Oh, no. It didn't affect him at all in any way. He went past that. He hated being addicted. He hated it. I told him... I said, I guess you didn't get enough love when you were young. He said, oh, love. He said, I wish someone would have hit me and knocked me out when the first time I took a needle. He said, that was the worst thing that ever happened to me. And he was very, very sick. At the end of his life, I can't tell you how hard it was. It was just absolutely horrid. He just would blow up. At the end of a performance, he would play everything and he would just blow up, and it was just filled up with water and fluid, and he'd have to lay down in the prone position and just wait until it all subsided. And I'll never forget that one night I was in a small little town somewhere, and I got this call from Bill Evans, it was 6 months before he died, and he said, Tony, he said, just think truth and beauty, he said, and just forget the rest. That was his last words to me.
Why do you think he said that?
Because he believed that that's the right way. He believed that that's what music's about. He believed that that's the road to correct music and correct living, truth and beauty. You know, that's what life is all about.
And you think he was able to keep in touch with that musically even when he was really sick?
Oh, he went past the sickness. He just had to do it. He had this, he was compulsive about just playing better and better and better. I mean, it was amazing, the intensity. He was a genius at the... He bridged the gap. I mean, before, the classical music always wanted to play jazz, and they couldn't quite make it. And jazz artists wanted to play classical, and they couldn't quite make it. He found a way to bridge the gap. He was able to swing and still had classical background. So that's when people like Charlie Parker and Miles Davis, when they heard him playing, they said, God, I have to sing with this guy. They couldn't believe what they were listening to. The resolvements in the music that he was playing was so fantastic. They had never heard anything like that. He was that good.
I want to ask you about Duke Ellington. It seems like you had a really nice relationship with him. You say that he used to send you flowers after he wrote a new song.
Yeah, every time he wrote a new song, he sent me flowers.
Why did he do that?
Well, because he was a gentleman. it's old-fashioned, but it was correct. He was just courteous to people that he liked.
Did he want you to sing the song? Is that why he sent them to you? I'm sure he didn't send flowers to everyone he knew after he wrote a song.
No, he liked me, and we were close. Our families were close, and he was another master, great master, and it's funny, people don't realize it, but there are more recordings of his music than the Beatles. Every musician, everywhere in the world, wherever I go, I'll go into some cabaret somewhere, or I'll listen to a radio in Denmark or Sweden or Belgium, and you'll hear a Duke Ellington song. Every musician just loves Duke Ellington.
Would you choose an Ellington song that you recorded that you'd like us to play?
Solitude is fine.
Good, let's hear that. And this is Tony Bennett.
In my solitude, you haunt me. With reveries of days gone by, in my solitude, you taunt. I'm filled with despair. There's no one could be so sad. With gloom everywhere, I sit and I stare. I know.
That's Tony Bennett singing Duke Ellington's Solitude. Did you have personal relationships with a lot of songwriters?
Yes, I did. Harold Arlen was my very favorite. And I never met Ye Parberg, but Harold Arlen told me that Ye Parberg was the best lyric writer that ever lived. And he wrote with everyone, Ira Gershwin. I met Ira Gershwin. He was fantastic. But I had personal relationships with Sammy Kahn and Jimmy Van Heusen. And Jack Siegel, Alan and Marilyn Bergman.
Did anybody write songs especially for you? I know you were often asked to be the first person to record a song.
Mm-hmm. Johnny Mercer wrote I Want to Be Around for me. Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting story. You want to tell it?
Well, it's a wonderful story. You know, Sadie Vimmerstadt was a fan in Youngstown, Ohio, and she was an amateur, a songwriter. And she wrote, I want to be around to pick up the pieces when somebody breaks your heart. She wrote a fan letter to Johnny Mercer. And she said, "Johnny, this sounds like something you would write," she said. And so he got such a kick out of it, he wrote the song, finished it, and gave her 50% of the song. And Sadie would send me, after the song was a hit, she would send me cards from all over, from Paris, from Russia, from England, and she'd say, "Thanks so much, Tony." I think she's the only songwriter that really went overboard in thanking me for recording her song. But she took vacations all over the world with the money that she made from that song.
How did Johnny Mercer choose you to record it?
Well, he was living in England there for a while, and so was I, and we just started making a little contact, and then a fella called Phil Zeller, who did his promotion for him, and from his music publishing company, told me, "Johnny wrote this song and would want you to do it."
Well, let's hear it. This is "I Want to Be Around," Tony Bennett.
Be around to pick up the pieces when somebody breaks your heart. Somebody twice as smart as I. But somebody who will swear to be true as you used to do with me, who'll leave you to learn that misery loves company. Wait and see. I mean, I wanna be around to see how he does it when he breaks your heart to bits. Let's see if the puzzle fits so fine. And that's when I'll discover that revenge is sweet, as I sit there applauding from a front row seat. When somebody breaks your heart like you broke mine.
Tony Bennett recorded in 1963. We'll hear more of his interview with Terry after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1998 interview with Tony Bennett. He turned 80 this week.
You know, it's funny. There was a period in your life when, after Clive Davis became the president of Columbia Records, when you were asked to do a lot of cover songs of the rock and pop hits of the day. And you often didn't like those songs and didn't feel they were appropriate for you. The idea was to get you to sell to younger audiences. You did your best to always just do songs that you loved, and it's interesting now. You've developed a following on the part of younger people who listen to rock and roll. And you did your MTV Unplugged show, and the record and the show were a tremendous hit. I'm interested in how you kind of got connected that way, and what role perhaps your son Danny, who's been managing your career, played in maybe bridging the gap between the generations.
Well, Danny came up to me one day and said, "You know that my my songs are starting to connect with people his age. I said, you're kidding. So he put me on SCTV up in Toronto with John Candy, and then...
I remember that. You did the Fish and Magician. Not the Fish and Magician. What was it called? The Fish and...
I forget now.
Yeah, well, you went fishing with him, and your head blew up. Well, why don't we hear something from the Unplugged CD, and this is It Had to Be You.
Thank you.
It seems like dreams, like I've always had, could be, should be, making me glad. Why am I blue? It's up to you to explain. I'm thinking maybe, baby, I'll go away. Someday, some way, maybe you'll come and say, it's you that I need, and you'll be pleading in vain. It had to be you. It had to be you. I wandered around and finally found that somebody who could make me be true, could make me be blue. Even be glad just to be sad, thinking of you. Some others I've seen might never be mean.
That's Tony Bennett from his Unplugged CD, and he has a new memoir called The Good Life. You know, we were talking before about composers that you've known, and I'm wondering if any composers have given you a deeper understanding of a song that you sang by kind of talking to you about the song or by singing a line of it for you, emphasizing a certain word.
Well, yes. Harold Arlen told me to always exaggerate, you know, and change it any way you want to. He said, my songs are nothing but a tool to perform with. He said, whatever you want to do with a song, just do it. He said, just exaggerate it. And you know, instead of saying, don't know why there's no, say, don't know why there's no sun up in the sky, you know, just dramatize it. But that's the smallest part of it. The best example is Ernie Harburg. He wrote a book called Who Put the Rainbow in the Wizard of Oz? And he explained that his father said the way to detect a good song, to find a good song, is if the music hits you emotionally and the words hit you intellectually, he said then it's almost positive that you have a very good song.
Shall we end with a Harold Arlen song?
I'd love it.
Tony Bennett, it's just been a delight to speak with you. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much.
Tony Bennett speaking with Terry Gross in 1998. Bennett turned 80 this week.
I've got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow. Got the string around my finger. What a world, what a life. I'm in love. I've got a song that I sing. I can make the rain go anytime I move my little finger. Lucky me. Can't you see I'm in love?
Coming up, a review of the new film Little Miss Sunshine. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The black comedy Little Miss Sunshine revolves around a 7-year-old girl and her dream of winning a children's beauty pageant. The movie is the feature debut of the husband and wife team of Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris, who made their names directing music videos for groups like R.E.M. and the Smashing Pumpkins. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
On paper, this year's Sundance Festival fave Little Miss Sunshine sounds like it might be one of those heartwarming, quirky with a capital Q dark comedies that do so well on the indie film circuit. And it is. Except it arrives at the warm and fuzzies via the back door without going squishy. The movie's premise is buoyant and semi-creepy, since it involves one of those kiddie beauty pageants that many of us associate with poor JonBenet Ramsey. A pageant where little girls wear tons of makeup and parade around in scanty costumes. Little Miss Sunshine centers on a family road trip from Albuquerque to California to a pageant in which 7-year-old Olive, played by Abigail Breslin, is an improbable finalist. It's odd because she isn't kiddie pageant material. She's a pretty and unaffected little dumpling with a stuck-out tummy. She wants to compete, but does she have the right icky stuff? Her family is supportive, but has troubles of its own. Her father, played by Greg Kinnear, runs a business preaching can't-miss strategies for success and has so far been an abject failure. She can't take much inspiration from her mother, played by Toni Collette, who's high-strung and barely holding the family together. And her mom's hands are full with her own brother, played by Steve Carell. He's a gay Proust scholar who just attempted suicide. Over dinner with the family, plus the pugnacious grandpa, played by Alan Arkin, the curious little girl tries to make sense of her uncle's sudden arrival and the bandages on his wrists.
How did it happen?
How did what happen?
Your accident.
Honey, here.
Oh, no, it's okay. Unless you object.
Oh. No, I'm pro-honesty here. I just think, you know, it's up to you.
Be my guest.
Olive, Uncle Frank didn't really have an accident. What happened was he tried to kill himself.
You did? Why?
I'm sorry. I don't think this is an appropriate conversation. Honey, let's let Uncle Frank finish his dinner, okay? Shh.
Why did you want to kill yourself?
No, don't answer the question, Frank.
Richard.
Don't answer it.
Richard.
He's not going to answer the question, Frank.
I wanted
Richard.
To kill myself.
Don't listen to him.
Richard.
I was very
He's
unhappy.
A sick man. He's a sick in his head man.
Richard.
I'm sorry. I don't think it's an appropriate conversation for a 7-year-old.
Well, she's going to find out anyway.
Oh, okay.
Go on, Frank.
Why were you unhappy?
Well, there were a lot of reasons. Mainly, though, I fell in love with someone who didn't love me back.
Who?
One of my grad students. I was very much in love with him.
Him? It was a boy? You fell in love with the boy?
Yes, I did. Very much so.
That's silly.
You're right. It was silly. It was very, very silly.
There's another word for it.
Dad.
At first, it seems as if the movie's purposely tacky Americana will be too nudge-nudge, wink-wink. But Michael Arndt's script has so much comic invention that the whimsy never stagnates, and the characters grow in stature and become affecting. Under the direction of Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris, the cast is a motley delight. Kinnear has grown into his lightweight persona, by which I mean he shed the snottiness that lingered from his old TV show Talk Soup. Here, he finds layer upon layer of vulnerability in his character's can-do sitcom hardiness. Toni Collette makes a fierce yet ultimately fragile counterweight. Arkin shows off the kind of genius timing that leavens his character's defeatism. And Paul Dano plays the weirdo brother who's 9 months into a vow of silence, inspired by Friedrich Nietzsche, with such angry, beseeching eyes that he's more than a one-joke character. The surprise is Steve Carell, who gives a superb interior performance. You can always see the wheels turning, more often grinding. And then there's the magical Abigail Breslin, who brings an undercurrent of sadness to a girl who will never be Shirley Temple. Thank God. Little Miss Sunshine is the rare comedy that piles on defeat after setback after disaster without losing its helium. Michael Dana's playful score gooses the action along, and the family's Have a Nice Day yellow Volkswagen bus holds its own against the mythic desert vistas. Having lost its clutch, that bus needs a group push to start, but like the movie, seems to run on sheer pluckiness. Every one of these characters comes up against a major obstacle and loses. Loses badly enough to make a person want to pack it in. But when life hands them a lemon, they don't just make lemonade. They learn to spike it with whiskey and dance their heads off. This is an enchanting anthem to loserdom.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of Sailing from Byzantium, How a Lost Empire Shaped the World, An Account of the Byzantine Empire and Its Ongoing Legacy by Colin Wells. From Endless Pools, The Treadmill for Swimmers, Installed Indoors or Out. DVD available at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. And from Jim and Karen Frank. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor John C. Reilly talks about his life and work, from Boogie Nights to his Oscar-nominated performance in Chicago. He's now appearing with Will Ferrell as a NASCAR driver in Talladega Nights. I'm Dave Davies. Join us for the next Fresh Air.